you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Welcome to Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me for this very fun episode, dangerous episode, because we're talking about Conan, is our pal Andy Leyland. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rob. It's lovely to be here. I'm a big fan of Treasury Cast for obvious reasons, because it is the best format comics have ever been released in.
I totally agree. Thank you so much for doing it. It's very exciting to finally have you on the show. You talked very early on. I think it was like after episode 2, you wrote me and said, if you ever want to talk about Conan, I would love to do it. And I was like, oh, I want to get to it. And then we kept doing like Christmas episodes, special episodes. But now we're here to talk about Marvel Treasury Edition number 4, Conan the Barbarian, which reprints the Red Nail saga, one of the more famous stories in Conan's history. This book was on sale February 4th, 1975. But before we talk about this specific book, Andy, like, I know that the Treasuries made it over to England because I've seen ads for them. Like, they had, you know, ads for the Treasuries. And I, as far as I understand, they came over the Treasuries that we have here in America are pretty much the same books that you had in England. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they're exactly the same. They're identical. The only difference is mine has 50 pence on the cover instead of whatever it cost over in America. Was it 75 cents at this point?
They were a dollar.
All right, so mine was 50p, which was probably about right exchange rate-wise. I would see the adverts for these in my dad's Marvel comics when he moved in with my mum. My stepdad, really, but he's my dad. When he moved in with my mum, he brought boxes of the early 70s Marvel UK stuff, Mighty World of Marvel, Planet of the Apes, Spider-Man Comics Weekly, and I would see these adverts for the Treasury Editions. But I didn't actually get one until I had the Star Wars 2, because Marvel were absolutely marvellous, no pun intended, about getting the Star Wars stuff out there into people's hands in every conceivable format, in every place that you could possibly go. So I had the Star Wars ones. But the only Treasuries I had as a teen were two that my grandparents bought for me for a birthday from a mail order company. I had the one where they reprint Amazing Spider-Man 100, 101, and 102, the six-arm Morbius saga. And I had the Fantastic Four one, where the lead-off story was the christening of Franklin Richards, where Ben gets all tearful that they name him Franklin Benjamin Richards. This is something, the Treasuries are one of those things that as soon as eBay became a thing, I did start buying as soon as I could. And one of the first ones I bought, well, back in 96, 97, when eBay really kicked off, I got the Superman Spider-Man Treasury Edition.
Oh, boy.
The first one, absolutely adore that. And the second one, which I had the British version of, which was a British magazine size, but not actually a Treasury size. So I finally got the actual Treasury of the Superman Spider-Man one. And I've slowly been building up a collection of these things as and when I see them and when they're not horrendously priced. Because some of them are.
Some of them are, yeah, absolutely. Some get a little pricey for sometimes for no good reason. Like, what are some of your favorites, like, as an adult? Like, one of the ones you've bought in the recent past?
Batman Hulk.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
Is absolutely fantastic. I'm just looking off here. Excuse me, while I scrape my chair. Makes for great audio. I love the first Spider-Man, which has the story where he's fighting Dr. Octopus. That you've already talked about on the show. That's absolutely fantastic. I love the Star Wars ones because they just time you back into being a kid. And I'm a big fan of the DC one where they republish all of the Neil Adams Ra's al Ghul stories.
Mm-hmm.
That story just reeks of Bond drama, cinematic genius, long before anyone came up with the term cinematic comics. That reprint of the Ra's al Ghul stuff is brilliant. Now, I'm normally a massive fan of Neil Adams' Batman work being in black and white, because A, that's how I grew up reading it in the British reprints, but B, there's a gothic horror undertone to Neil Adams' work that works beautifully in black and white. But those Ra's al Ghul stories are just gorgeous in full Treasury-sized colour. When he's on the Alps,
oh yeah,
taking out Ubu and that gorgeous, gorgeous page of Race Rash coming out of the Lazarus Pit. And the new wraparound cover as well. Love it.
That is one of the great things about the Treasure is that if they, you know, get an artist whose work is really sumptuous and beautiful, it's great seeing it at that size. And that's we have that here because, of course, Conan the Barbarian reprints Conan work by Barry Windsor Smith. And the cover, which is interesting because the first three Marvel Treasuries were full bleed covers. This one puts this drawing done by Windsor Smith of Conan hacking into some enemies. It puts it in a box. And I'm guessing with a white frame, and I assume that the reason for that is to make it look a little more book-like, you know, to give it kind of like a paperback book sort of feel, because it's an interesting cover choice for a comic book. Normally you don't see this kind of design.
No, well, Roy Thomas does say in the introduction, doesn't he, that Barry has took to doing a lot of design work for other things, and he says including the cover to this edition. I think you're absolutely spot on. I think they're very much trying to conjure up images on the bookshelf of the Conan paperbacks that were very prevalent in the 70s with them. Were they Boris Vulgeo covers?
I believe so, yeah.
So I think they're very definitely going for that market. But it also has the advantage of being a treasury that if you just flip over to the back cover, you've got the whole thing unadorned by logos.
Yep.
So you get the best of both worlds, though. You get the full cover on the back, which is simply glorious. I think it's a magnificent cover. Conan just stood upon masses and masses of dead bodies as he hacks his way through whoever the hell these guys are, covered in blood himself. There's a head on a pike behind him. Perhaps, maybe, putting it in a box, as well as evoking the cover, but also 70s Marvel cover designs generally on their comics. Perhaps there's a little bit less violence to it if it's done that way on the cover.
Yeah, he is really tearing into these guys, as we see. He's like literally standing on piles of bodies with his axe and stuff. And the rain is falling. It's a beautiful image. It's really, really gorgeous.
So, absolutely fantastic.
And so the inside cover features, as Andy mentioned, an editorial by Roy Thomas, who, of course, wrote all these stories. And there's two little inset drawings, one of Roy as he looked then, another one of Barry Windsor Smith, who looked kind of Jesus-like.
Another one of Jesus, yeah.
So when you walk with Barry Windsor Smith, you never walk alone. So we have Roy Thomas talking about comic storytelling, and he talks about the history of the Conan book and about how many awards the book has won. And, I mean, you know, definitely sort of getting at the notion that the Conan comic was appealing to a broader audience than comic book readers. You know, there were Conan came with a lot of fan base from all the novels and stuff. So they went over and sort of followed the comic book series. So he talks about that a bit, gets into Barry's work and stuff like that. And it's interesting that we will see in just this book the evolution of Smith's style, because as we know, Barry Windsor Smith started as kind of a Kirby clone. It didn't take long, though, before he established his own very unique style. His work doesn't look like anybody else's. And there's a front piece to the book where we see a nice half shot of Conan with his sword and his shield, and gives us the table of contents. It does mention, it says, Roy Thomas, writer, editor, Barry Smith, artist, with the special assist from Silvio Buscema. Not Sal Buscema, Silvio Buscema, which I think is kind of interesting. And then it thanks Glenn Lord and Robert E. Howard, without whom this book would consist of 100 blank pages. So it starts up, the first story that it starts up with is from Conan the Barbarian number 11, Rogues in the House by Thomas Smith and the aforementioned Silvio Buscema. And said it opens up with Conan sits in chains in a Corinthian jail after being betrayed by a beautiful woman named Jenna, who drugged his wine. Murillo, a Corinthian lord who comes to the jail with an offer to free the barbarian if he kills Nabonidus, the secret head of the city, as the lord is concerned with the red priest's pillaging ways. Meanwhile, Conan escapes on his own, seeking vengeance on Jenna. He finds and kills Igon, Jenna's beloved, on the way, then throws Jenna off the roof into a steaming pile of garbage in the alley. Then he turns his sights on Nabonidus. And then we have part two of the story. Conan sneaks onto the priest's grounds and encounters Murillo, who has been sneaking through the sewer tunnel himself and confronting Nabonidus after discovering the priest is in reality a brutish ape monster. Further investigation in the tunnels finds the unconscious body of Nabonidus himself. The priest comes to and explains that the creature Murillo encountered was Thak, an ape man captured as a cub by Nabonidus to be a servant. Fak began to get ambitions of his own and cold-cocked his master, taking his place on the throne. Conan also discovers that Murillo is not as noble as he seems, as he has been selling state secrets. The three rogues go to confront Thak and observe him through two-way mirrors rampaging through the house. Eventually, the men are trapped in a locked room as Thak storms at them. Conan and Murillo manage to slay the giant beast. The Bondadus takes the opportunity to try and sneak away, but is slain by a thrown dagger from Conan. Conan then decides to leave Corinthia entirely. So what do you think of this as a story, and how do you think it works as a one to pick for the treasury?
I think it's a great story. It's almost typical Conan. You know, there's walls to be climbed, there's women to be shagged, there's people to be killed, and that's pretty much, there's money to be earned, and that's pretty much Conan's raison d'etre. Now, one of the things I do have to say is my love of Conan came from a completely different place to everything else. When I was growing up, I didn't read Conan. I thought Conan was going to be big, muscly guy in loincloth, sweats and grunts his way through sword and sorcery adventures. And I wasn't into that. I wasn't into sword and sorcery. And what happened was, I don't know if you found this in doing your podcasts, but I found that a lot of people loved hearing you talk about stuff about which you know nothing. And so Michael and I, when we were doing Hey Kids Comics, we decided, all right, let's throw the doors open. What do you want us to talk about that we know nothing about? And it was G.I. Joe, Transformers, and Conan. Now, with G.I. Joe, I got a couple of people who I knew were big G.I. Joe fans. I think Luke Giaconetti and J. David Weiter, and they recommended me a couple of comics. With G.I. Joe, I could fully get into what the appeal was with those comic book stories, independent of the toy line. With Transformers, that was still a boat that left me on the island. I can only assume I was just that little bit too old for Transformers, and even reading the comic books did nothing for me. And then we got to Conan. And Red Nails was one of the stories that we read, along with, I can't remember what it was, a black and white one from Savage Sword of Conan. And I absolutely adored it, in the sense that it was everything I thought Conan was going to be, but there was so much more meat to it than just that. And this is a perfect Conan introductory story, even if you've never read Conan before. It's based on a Robert E. Howard story, or certainly Red Nails is. Oh, yeah, this one is as well. Whereas the early comic books, Roy Thomas says in an introduction later to the Conan trades from Dark Horse stories for a while until the estate saw how well the stories were being received and how well the comic book was selling. And so they started adapting actual stories. And this is a perfect Conan story in that it's remarkably rich. There's an awful lot of depth to this story that you didn't think you were going to get from Sword and Sorcery. But the character of Conan is, on the one hand, he's so simple. He likes money. He likes fighting. He likes women. And that's it. That's all there is to his character. But there's a brilliant myth. I mean, I don't know if he comes in and out of the stories throughout the first year or so of the book. And here, just him throwing her out of the window.
That's such a great moment.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I was like, should I have found that as funny as I did?
Oh, it's hysterical. I mean, it's, you know, he's. I mean, in the beginning, he likes her because he's betting her down. And then we find out that she's betrayed him. You know, and you're like, well, now we know that she's marked now. I mean, I'm surprised that he doesn't kill her. I guess maybe they thought that might have been a little too much. But instead, he just pitches her over the side into the sewage, which is just fantastic. You know, I mean, and the way he holds her, too, he's so humiliating. Like, he's got her under his arm, and he's just carrying her. And he just chucks her over the side, you know, for gold, Jenna, for and gold.
Laughs, and he throws her. And he laughs hysterically as she fights her way through the sewage and garbage where he's thrown her. But yeah, I mean, Conan is, in these early stories, there isn't a lot to his character. But I think what also struck me was how adult this story was. Considering this was being published and going on shelves alongside Amazing Spider-Man and Captain America, you know, the opening page has a naked woman in bed. And just the general overall tone of the story is a lot deeper and more adult than anything else Marvel was publishing at the time. So I can see why it was a big seller to people who didn't normally read comics, because apparently Conan was a massive hit on the newsstands,
right,
in the same way that Star Wars was a massive hit on the newsstands. It was reaching people who didn't venture into comic book stores, even though they didn't really have them in the 70s. But that's one of the arguments against comic book stores, is this kind of book doesn't have an audience anymore.
Right.
People, casual purchasers, would buy Conan and read Conan because it had an element to it, an edge to it that the regular stuff didn't have. And the same with Star Wars. And the fact that they were selling this on newsstands and they were getting away with some of this stuff was brilliant. I really enjoyed this story. You're absolutely right about early Winsor Smith artwork. He is a Kirby clone in exactly the same way Sienkiewicz started as a Neil Adams clone.
Right, right.
But exactly like Bill Sienkiewicz, he quickly evolved into his own style very, very quickly. He didn't just remain a clone. And I think this is a great and thoroughly entertaining story. Again, I don't know what your Conan backstory is. Are you a fan of Conan?
Yeah, no, I always liked Conan. I mean, you're right. He doesn't have any inner monologue, really. You know, he's just wine, women, and song, and cutting people's heads off. That's pretty much it. I saw the movie when I was a kid, and I had the Power Records. I love those. And I liked the comic book, but the comic book is never, I mean, I'm not an expert at it. I haven't read every one, but the comic book is sort of going to give, you know what you're going to get. And if you like that thing, then get the Conan comic book. But don't buy Conan if you're expecting some exploration of morality or any sort of, you know, philosophical thing. It's just Conan's going to meet a monster. He's going to bed some women down. He's going to get betrayed by somebody. He's going to cut some heads off. That's what this story is. And that's kind of what this is. This has a little more to it. You've got the ape man and all this, but it is following that formula, but it's a good formula. It's a solid formula. And in terms of the artwork, you can see Winsor Smith's style evolving. I mean, there are some faces here that are very Kirby-like, but then there are other panels that look more like what his style would eventually grow to become. And we'll see that full flower in the Red Nails stories in a moment. But we can see, this is like him in the middle of that. And so it's nice to look at in a big format, of course. And these later on, they'll talk about the Red Nail stories. This is the first time we're seeing them in color as well. So, I mean, it's a good presentation it's a great first story to have, considering that Red Nails is a three-parter. This one needed to be just self-contained. And it works really well. It's an extra long story because the issue of Conan was extra long. It's good. It's a good, fun adventure. And it ends the way most Conan stories have to, with him just wandering on to the next town. Because he's like, I've almost gotten killed here. I threw a woman off a cliff. What the hell? I just take off and go on, have next adventure. So it's a good story.
Yeah, it's a very entertaining introduction to the world of Conan. And that's exactly what it is. I can't imagine this had many female fans.
No, probably not.
Because Conan's treatment of women is less than evolved, I think we should say.
I would say that, yeah. I don't know. I mean, he's not that kind of guy.
I mean, he's not an anti-woman. I don't think he's a misogynist in any way. But as far as Conan's concerned, women are there for one reason.
Basically, yeah. I mean, as we will establish later on with Red Sonja, like, he likes a woman that can sort of meet him toe-to-toe. And that's what Red Sonja is, somebody who can do the kind of things he likes to do, which is, again, cutting people's heads off and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, that's what he's all about. So after the story, we get a bonus feature, which is a nice double-page spread of the Hyborian Age of Conan, which is a map of Hyboria. And we see all the, you know, different lands that Conan travels. And apparently, I guess if you're like a real Conan fanaticist, there's a way to like track his travels in continuity, to like read the books and go through, okay, he went here, then he went here. I mean, for someone who read the comic book intermittently, it was like, all right, he's just in another crazy part of wherever land this is. But I guess if you're a Conan completist, this stuff is interesting to you. And this was something that Roy Thomas got into. He was a big fan, was like sort of really keeping tabs on where Conan went from adventure to adventure. So that's one of the nice little bonus features you get in these treasuries.
I especially like in this particular map that he's put where each issue took place, where they were up to when this was published.
Yeah, that's a nice little feature. That's a handy little bonus there, which, again, one of the things I love about these treasuries. So, and then next up is what you paid your money for, which is the Red Nails saga, adapted, again, of course, by this story by Robert, I'm sorry, hold on. And, of course, this is the story adapted from Robert E. Howard. So, Andy, take it away.
Red Nails Part 1 opens with Valeria of the Red Brotherhood horse after she's left from Sukhumet, where she killed an officer who laid a hand upon her. She's having a look around the area when she bumps into Conan. The mighty Cimmerian informs her that he followed her, for he finds her desirable. Along the way, he slit the throat of the man who was pursuing her for killing the officer who laid a hand upon her. They both pursued by a big old dragon. And they get away from the dragon by poisoning it with Durkata apples, which are on this rocky outcropping where they both live. They see a walled city around them, and they break in through the city gates. Whilst the city is domed and ornate, there are no signs of life. Conan explores why Valeria tries to rest, but she gets involved in a fight between a man and a skeleton creature. The first man is killed, but there is a second man who Valeria managed to save. The second man is named Tekhutul, who tells Valeria that the clan Xotalanc may be creeping up on them, for the skull of the dead freezes the blood and withers the brain of all who gaze upon it, and to touch it would bring madness and death. A staggering wind then rages around them, and if they were the screams of a man, Valeria and Tekhutul flee to find Conan. Part 2, the lurker from the catacombs. Conan arrives as Valeria is fighting more Exotalancus as Tekhutul watches. There's a lot of confusing names in this story, which is why the synopsis took longer than I thought it would. Valeria explains the situation to Conan, that there are two warring factions both living at different ends of this domed city, with the Xoxolcatans and the Tekhutul, and the threesome make their way to Tekhutul. There they are greeted by Prince Olmec and Princess Taskela, who fill them in on the rather convoluted backstory. More than 50 years ago, a rebel tribe were defeated and fled the city, happening upon the walled city that they are now in. A slave, Tolkemek, from inside the city, struck a deal with the rebels and let them in exchange for freedom. And the battle was swiftly won by the rebels, specifically, two brothers, Tekhutul and Xotalanc. For 5 years, the two tribes lived as one. But then Xotalanc took a wife, whom Xotalanc also desired, who Tolkemek desired, sorry, and the treacherous slave that they helped earlier helped them betray the brother. It was brother versus brother in mortal combat, while Tolkemek played both sides against the middle, but the Tekhutul stormed in and both brothers were slain. Tolkemek was dispatched to the catacombs, never to be seen again, and the feud continues to this day. Conan feels this is no concern of his, but before he can leave, Olmec offers him wealth if he and Valeria stay to help win the battle. Conan is all about the money, and later that night, they agree to fight, but Valeria is accosted in her quarters by Princess Taskela. Valeria fights her off, but then tortures Taskela to find out what she wanted, but Taskela escapes into the same catacombs where Kemet was last seen. The Xotalancans choose that moment to attack, and following a pitched battle, they are defeated, and the Tekhutul stand victorious. Conan is sent to find out if this was all of the Xotalancans, where it turns out that Olmec has betrayed him and wants him out of the way. Conan quickly dispatches the guards who were told to kill him and runs back to the city, where he finds that Olmec has tried it on with Valeria, but Princess Taskela has drugged Olmec because she wants Valeria for herself. Conan finds Olmec, who's trapped in a big torture device, and he lets him go in exchange for Olmec taking him to where Princess Taskela is. Olmec tells Conan that Princess Taskela is a witch, taught the secret of eternal youth aeons ago, but to retain that youth, she needs to remove the life force of a younger woman, which is what she wants Valeria for. Conan and Olmec make it there, but at the last moment, Olmec betrays Conan, so Conan strangles him. Conan then attacks without thought, failing to see an iron trap which coils around his foot. He's trapped as Taskela moves in towards Valeria, but then at the last minute, Tolkemek arrives from the catacombs. Conan notices that the huge wand that he has that fires crimson rays needs metal between it and its target to work, and so he and Tolkemek face off in heated battle, where Conan manages to avoid the ray, hurling a blade, deep into Tolkemek's heart. Conan and Valeria kill Taskela and then decide they want no more of this vile place nor its riches and wander off to another part of the country. When we were talking about this the other day, I said your synopsis in this show is a normally dead shot. This'll be a breeze.
I have to thank you for taking the bit in your teeth and volunteering to do the recap of this one.
Oh, man. I mean, it's not that this isn't a great story. I mean, it's a full... Is it 40 pages? 35 pages? Something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a full-bodied story. It's very gripping, very well-written, but there's an awful lot to have to take in. Olmec, Taskela, the Exoletans, Valeria, the Tekkels. There's a lot in this going on. I like Valeria as a character. I think she's very interesting. Excuse me. I think she's very interesting. I'm not too enamoured with the Conan that has followed her for the sole purpose of raping her. I can live with the Conan who thinks that women are there to service his needs because he's a barbarian. I'm not too fond of a rapey Conan. Yeah. And the fact that over the course of this story, he actually learns to appreciate her for what she is, which goes back into what you were saying earlier on, that he likes a strong woman. I thought that was quite a good piece of development and growth for him, that he actually saw that women were worth a little bit more than he gave her credit for. I do love the opening, where they're on the rocky outcropping and they see the domed walled castle, and the big dragon. And I love Conan's intelligence in figuring out that the apples that are growing are poisonous, but they can use them to escape from the dragon. I thought that was absolutely brilliant stuff. And this story, it's beautifully drawn.
This is Smith in full flower. It's just it's stunning work.
Yeah, and it's coloured for the first time, whereas in the Savage Sword of Conan volumes, it's black and white. I love Red Nails. I think Red Nails, if you've never read a Conan story before, Red Nails is the place to start.
Yeah, this is one of the storylines you hear about. Like, there's, you know, for any comic book character who's been around for more than a year, storylines develop of like, oh, that's, you know, you want to be introduced to this person, read this storyline. You know, you have that for Batman or Wonder Woman or Spider-Man, you know, it's like, oh, read this storyline, or read the Captain America. You got to read these comics. Red Nails is always one of the ones you hear about for Conan. And so, you know, this is the Treasury editions being trade paperbacks before there were trade paperbacks. You know, we're like collecting these things. I mean, they were reprinted in, they were first printed in Savage Tales, Marvel's magazine, which of course, you know, probably the average comic book reader didn't either have access to, or even if they did, didn't read them. You can tell a little bit because they are a little more adult. I mean, there are shots of Valeria topless, which, you know, you don't see anything, but it's more suggestive certainly than a code-proofed comic could get away with, and they didn't have to submit these to the code, I guess, these treasuries, so they could get away with that. So you were probably, a lot of people reading these were reading them for the first time, and collecting them all in between two covers is great. And like I said, it's the work here of Smith is just startling. The line work is beautiful, and you really get to see all the detail at this large size. And the intro, where he's in the forest with Valeria, this is the kind of thing that, when you're a kid, I think appeals to you when you're reading Conan stories, is that kind of like the Ray Harryhausen movies, where the Jason and the Argonauts and stuff, where, you know, you're just out in the forest and you're having a normal day, and then a dragon can just come out of nowhere and try and kill you. And then, you know, this is a normal world, except for these monsters that lurk in any place that get ready to eat you at a moment's notice. And I love all that kind of stuff. It's so exciting. It's not the world you want to live in, but you want to read about it because it's just so thrilling.
It's very exciting, yeah. And again, the sacrifice at the end, Valeria's completely naked on the sacrificial table. The battles in this are incredibly bloody. I mean, there's a scene on page 78 of the Treasury where Conan runs somebody through. Mm-hmm. And this is no Frank Miller killing Electra thing. That sword comes out the back of that guy's spine, and there's blood everywhere. The level of blood and gore in this is fantastic. I still maintain that if they made a TV show of Conan and they made it like Spartacus, it would be a massive hit. If they embraced the blood and the gore and the nudity and the sex and really went for it, I think this could be a fantastic series. And there's also, this Red Nail story is also a horrific story. There's a lot of wonderful horror images in it of skeletons without jaws and the hunting that's going on down in the catacombs and the betrayal that goes on a regular basis. On every other page, the sides that Conan's fighting for are changing. And there is a lovely bit in the middle of this where Olmec tells him that big, long, convoluted history of the city, and Conan turns to leave. Conan actually turns his back on him and he's going, right, well, this is now doing me, I'm off. And it's only when the guy offers him like a purse full of coin that Conan's like, oh, all right then, well, I can kill these guys just as well as I can kill anyone else. I may as well learn something. And that, And there's a brilliant moment as well, brilliant moment of characterization, where at the end, where they're shown to the rooms, and Valeria is taken to a separate quarters from Conan, and Conan's face is like, hey, what's going on?
Crom. You're right also about the violence. On page 76, when we get this, Smith gives this establishing shot of the battle in this dining room, and we see that there are just bodies littered everywhere, laying in pools of blood. I mean, it looks like the Red Wedding from Game of Thrones. I mean, it's just piles of bodies. And then in the next page, we see Prince Olmec slice a guy practically in half, like the guy's torso ripped open. And then in the bottom panel of that next page, 77, Conan is covered in blood. When someone goes, Conan, look out behind, he's just drenched in blood. And he, again, it's not something you would typically would ever see. And he continues to be. There's the next page, he has a dialogue scene with Olmec and Valeria, and he's just covered in blood. He doesn't bother to clean himself up. He's just standing there, just poured it. And that is, again, not something you would ever see in a typical comic book. And then there's the scene of all the heads on the wall and stuff. I mean, they really went for it. I mean, they're like, why not? You know, we can get away with it. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think we're audiences, thanks to Game of Thrones and Spartacus, are kind of used to that. We're accepting of that on television now. And it would be quite interesting to do. I mean, they made that Conan movie a couple of years ago starring Aquaman, but and that really didn't go anywhere. But it would be interesting to try and do Conan again. And you're right. I think a TV series would probably work better because his adventures have an episodic nature. You know, they work for him going from town to town doing these kinds of adventures. So I think that would actually be quite entertaining.
Yeah, and plotted out over 5 seasons, start when these stories started, when he was 19. Apparently he's 19 years old at the time of Conan the Barbarian issue 1. And take it all the way through King Conan. Over the each season of the show be about 5 years of his life.
Right.
And do it like that, plan it from start to end. I think that could be really effective. But yeah, I loved Red Nails. I loved Red Nails when I first read it, and I love it now. I think it's just an absolutely fantastic Conan story. Really entertaining. I love that at the end, he outsmarts the bad guy again, because again, one of my misconceptions with Conan, that he was a bit of a dumb lug, and he isn't. I mean, you know, he's not an enlightened man by any stretch of the imagination, but he's not thick. The guy knows battle, he knows people, he knows how to fight, and in the best way to go about it. And that shows his intelligence as well. And I think that's what makes him ultimately interesting. Mm-hmm. There is a lot more going on with him than you think there is. And this was just a brilliant Treasury edition. I love this.
Yeah.
100 pages of genius.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to live long in Hyboria unless you're both smart and lucky. And Conan is both those things. I mean, you know, otherwise you're just fodder for some monster or somebody poisoning you or whatever. I do. And you mentioned it in the synopsis a little, but I love that final page where Tassila is about to attack Conan and then she gets run through by Valeria. And we get that shot of Valeria just kicking the body over. And she's like, I had to do that much for my own self-respect. And Conan goes, well, that cleans up the feud. And he's like, well, that's that. I'm like, okay then, Conan, I guess we're done. And he heads off to go plunder with Valeria. It's fantastic. And then the book features also a pinup of Conan in battle. And it says, to the memory of Robert E. Howard, creator of Conan Call and the Age Undreamed Of. Beautiful drawing by Barry Windsor Smith. I mean, again, just the line work is just startling.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. There's an entire story in that poster.
Yeah. Oh, it's
of how he came to be there and what those fire arrows that are shooting at him, where they came from, and what's going on behind him and the girl that he's protecting. It's so good. As usual for something like this, the Roy Thomas introduction is brilliant as well. Full of fantastic behind-the-scenes information. He talked about how he couldn't resist Lucasizing this. apparently, he's rewritten a couple of lines of dialogue that he wasn't happy with, and Barry Windsor Smith added a bit of art here and there. He goes into greater depth in the Dark Horse Trades, the Chronicles of Conan. I've got the first 4 volumes, which is all of the Barry Windsor Smith run. And he talks in great detail about how the book was cancelled with issue 7 and then re-brought back within a day because he argued impassionately that sales were going up. He talks about how he licensed the character for $50 more per issue than he was actually given permission to do. He went to Martin Goodman because Stan had gone to him apparently and said, look, Sword and Sorcery is popular. Let's do some Sword and Sorcery books. And they got the idea of licensing an already existing character. Roy Thomas already liked Conan. So he went to the Robert E. Howard estate and explained to them that by having it as a comic book series, you could bring readers into your novels and expose your character to a completely different audience. And they went for it. But Marty Goodman had apparently licensed $150 per issue. And Roy Thomas was so embarrassed by that lowball figure for a literary giant like Robert E. Howard that he bumped it to $200 without telling Marty Goodman or Stanley.
I love that kind of stuff. You know, like Roy having faith in it. And of course, he was proven right because Conan was one of Marvel's biggest sellers for many years. And they ran they published Conan, I think, for what, 25 years? Something like that?
Hey, it went well into the 90s, didn't it? And there was other books as well. Conan, Savage Sword of Conan, King Conan. Every time, I mean, like you, I think you've mentioned on this show before, were four issues into Marvel Treasury editions. And Conan gets a treasury before the Hulk.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Before Captain America, before the Avengers, Conan got a treasury edition.
Yeah, they knew, you know, he was a big, big seller. And of course, now there's news that Conan is back at Marvel. After being at Dark Horse for many decades, he's coming back to Marvel. I guess Marvel's like, now that they've got that Disney money, they're like, well, we'll get Star Wars back, we'll get Conan back, we'll just get all our licenses back. We're going to go back. So, now, the Conan comic was one that, again, I mentioned earlier, that I would buy intermittently. It was frequently a mountain comic, because it was just a book I didn't buy regularly, but then when I was on vacation, I was like, well, I'm buying more stuff because I need more stuff to read. Oh, Conan. Perfect. So I will be getting just some Conan comics on the Mountain Comic series when that book comes back. But this as a treasury is really what the treasuries are for, is to kind of, you know, find some really great stuff. Maybe if you can find something that the average reader hasn't read, or at the very least something older that's off stands, and put it between two covers. And this is really like, I mean, the other Marvel treasures we've profiled so far, we did number one and two, the Spider-Man and Fantastic Four issues. Those are great collections, no doubt. But this is something where, like, let's find something that is, you know, really hard to find. It's and we'll collect it between a bunch of covers, and we'll give something that the general audience hasn't seen before. So it's really one of the best Marvel treasuries out there.
Yeah, it really is an example of taking the best material that we've got and getting it into the hands of people in other ways. Like the Treasury Edition probably wasn't sold on regular newsstands, I wouldn't imagine.
I remember I used to see them in regular newsstands, but not a lot. Like, you would see them, they tended to be at other, like department stores. We had at a, there was a department store chain here called JCPenney, which sells, like, you know, sell clothes and vacuum cleaners. And they also had, like, a newsstand, and that's where often I would get the treasuries. I didn't actually see them, like, in regular newsstands, like a candy vendor, that much. So, yeah, I think because of the price point was higher, they could get more of a return on them. And they said they were square bound, so they definitely had much more of a, you know, kind of a solid presentation. And so, yeah, this is a really, really great book. This is really very fun. And Conan would come back. He would get another treasury down the line, but we can get to that in a later episode. So, Andy, anything else you want to say about this particular treasury edition before we sign off?
It feels mighty in your hands, doesn't it?
It does.
It's got a weight to it that feels really quality, that the kind of thing you want when you're spending money on something. Both stories are good. I do think that, you know, maybe we've not given the first story, the Rogues in the House story, we haven't perhaps given the due that it deserves. It's a great story, but Red Nails is just—it's just so dense, isn't it? It's a 36, 40-page story, whatever it is, that has enough material in it nowadays for a six-issue miniseries.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah!
It's absolutely fantastic, and like Rob, like you were just saying, it's two great introductory stories to the character. Like I just said, it feels weighty in your hands. It's worth the money. It's just glorious. I'm glad you had me on for this one. I love this Treasury Edition.
Oh, I'm glad we finally got to it. I kept meaning to have you on to do this one, because again, Conan hasn't come up on the show yet, but then the events just get, we kept doing, oh, I have to do another Christmas episode, I have to do another this or that. That's the way it works out. But so I'm glad we finally got a chance to talk about it. It's a great, great book.
There is one other trivia note that I discovered when I was reading up on what to do for this. Apparently, this was almost an animated feature film with Ron Perlman as Conan. and Mark Hamill in it.
Really?
Yeah, apparently they were cast back in 2007, and then it went into development hell and never developed.
Huh.
So Red Nails could have been an animated feature film with Ron Perlman and Mark Hamill.
Wow. That would have been really interesting. Huh. Well, I'll have to say, Conan's a property. It's out there. You know, somebody can... They're making movies about everything now. I mean, all the properties are up for grabs, so why not? Why not give Conan another try? So very cool. So maybe someday we'll get to see it. So Netflix, come on, get on that. where can people find you, Andy, on the internet?
I am on tutrifreaks.com with The Palace of Glittering Delights, which is my slightly campy title for a pop culture show where I just look at whatever the hell I want to. But most recently, I did a look at two episodes of The Amazing Spider-Man series starring Nicholas Hammond. Fantasticast is something I do with Steve Lacey. That's available on fantasticast.com. And in that one, we've covered the Fantastic Four from the beginning to where we're up to at the minute, which is the end of the George Perez run, which is around the 190s. Listen to the Prophets I do with Bill Robinson and Paul Spataro, where we look at episodes of Deep Space Nine. That's also on twotruefreaks.com. And with Michael Bailey, I do the Overlook Dark Knight, where we just read Batman stories that we don't think get the love they deserve. And that's on fortressofbailitude.com.
Excellent. I have to say, I really do enjoy Fantasticast, because Fantastic Four is not... I like them just fine, but it was never a series that I read, especially... Well, I read the Byrne ones, but before that, I just don't have a lot of familiarity with Fantastic Four, so I've been going through your episodes, listening to... And those have been a lot of fun, because you guys bring a lot of high energy to it, so that's a really fun show.
We love the Fantastic Four, and even when the comics are utterly awful, the impetus behind the show is not to just slag them off mercilessly. The idea is, you know, a lot of this stuff, it means something to different eras, and so we try to find the positive even when it's Strange Tales, which was dreadful.
That is one of the things I like about it, is that you guys are very upbeat and positive about it, and I enjoy it. And I generally don't listen to podcasts where they're talking about comics I haven't read, because I just don't know what really a familiarity what we're talking about. But I have been enjoying Fantasticast quite a bit, so very cool.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Well, and thank you for having me on Treasury. I enjoy an awful lot of Fire and Water. Obviously, we're patting each other's backs now, but Treasury. Treasury Cast has been a favorite. Before I even knew who the hell you were, I would read treasury.com.
Oh, yes, Mike. I got to update that site someday. It's been so long.
Yeah, just a brilliant site. I loved treasury.com.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well said. It's been fun talking about these books. This is a fun show to do. I can only do it every so often, but I always enjoy it because I do love these books so much. So thank you so much, Andy, for coming on. I appreciate it. It's been great. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I want you to stay tuned. We're going to play some podcast promos. And when I get back, I'm going to do your listener feedback.
The Fantasticast is your guide to the Fantastic Four from the beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics in 1961 onwards.
Each week, Steve Lacey and Andy Leyland cover every issue, spin-off, guest appearance and cameo, and more.
And in 2015, we begin our journey through the decade that Taste forgot, the 1970s.
Join us as we take a look at...
the departure of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee.
The Kree-Skrull War.
The arrival of Marvel Team-Up.
Bill Murray as the Human Torch.
Creators including Roy Thomas, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Rich Buckler and John Byrne.
And of course, Marvel 2-in-1.
All this and more at ffcast.libsyn.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Fantastic Cast.
Insert catchy tagline here. Wait, what?
Guys, we finally developed our time machine. Should we use it to go back and see how Stonehenge was built?
Or become friends with Hitler and convince him to stay in art school? Or we could go back in time and get the comic books we missed.
Yeah!
The Comic Book Time Machine. A journey back in time to explore comic books. Good and bad. Whether from 7 decades ago or 7 days ago. Join our journey at comicbooktimemachine.com.
And we're back with your listener feedback for episode 21, which was Famous First Edition Batman #1 with Dan Greenfield. First off, from the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, Martin Gray says, great guest, excellent comic, fabulous episode all around. I never realized this contained, basically, Dick's first adventure as Robin. I was looking at the cover with Robin on the flagpole, and Dane's theory that the Joker was repurposed makes perfect sense. Smart fella. And you were great too, Rob. Well, thank you so much, Martin. And yes, Dan is very smart. That's an accurate observation. Ward Hill Terry says, this was a great and fun conversation. I love following the meandering bat conversation. Thanks for including the letter on the inside cover. I agree with you, Rob, that doesn't sound like Infantino, at least compared to the note with his name on it in Superman vs. Spider-Man. Could it have been Bridwell? He wrote the introduction to the Batman from the 1930s to 1970s book. It was there that I learned of Bill Finger and so much more of the Batman story. I had read and reread that book so many times before I started buying Batman and Detective regularly. In fact, my first purchase of Detective was Steve Englehart's first issue. Once Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin joined him on the title, they quickly made it look like the earliest issues of Batman, like this one, right down to the caption boxes with the circled initialed letter. To my eyes, those issues of Detective looked like what Batman comics were supposed to look like. I was intrigued by the publishing history you alluded to about Batman number one. I presume it was a bi-monthly title. The adjective titles were monthlies, and if they shifted a story from Detective to this, do you think that there might have been a rush to get to the stands? They would have been repairing it before Batman had been a year old. I also agree with Dan. They got so much right about these characters right away. One of my favoriteest comic stories is Englehart's run in Detective. Many of those panels are etched in my memory. One of my favorites is the footnote after Batman says, "You've turned men into monsters before." The footnote caption reads, "Batman, believe it or not, number one." I think I remember that, Ward Hill. The Englehart Marshall Rogers Terry Austin run is just one of the best ever. I mean, there's a reason why Tim Burton borrowed so heavily from it for the Batman movie. Ado Boznar writes in to say, great show as usual, especially with Mr. Greenfield as the guest. Interesting. I suppose somewhere in the back of my head, I knew Catwoman debuted in Batman number one, but usually I never think of her as showing up at the same time as the Joker. It always seems like she came a bit later. Also interesting that the flirtation between the two is established from the start. That seems only fitting because as much as I like the romances with Silver St. Cloud and even Talia, to me, Selina will always be the one and the true one and only for Bruce. I guess DC agrees with you because as we now know, Batman and Selina, Batman and Catwoman are getting married. Chris Franklin, of course, my partner from Superman Movie Minute and the host of JLU Cast over on our network, says, well, that was a fantastic episode. I could listen to you talk about Batman ad infinitum. I think Dan is the Earth One version of me, or vice versa. I own a copy of this treasure, though I had read the reprinted stories in numerous places before. I think fans of Nolan's Dark Knight who don't know comics would find this story very interesting. You could definitely see the influence of the story on that film, and of course the mood of these early Batman stories is very apparent in Burton's first Batman film as well, like I just said. Of course, the Golden Age-influenced Englehart Rogers Austin run helped inspire the earliest drafts of the Batman movie that evolved into Burton's first film. So it's all cyclical. I would love to see Batman vs. the Monster Men expanded into a full animated feature. The wonderful black and white short Bruce Timm did for the Batman 75th anniversary made me hungry for more. You know, I don't think I've ever seen that. I have to check that out. I'm not really even sure what you're talking about, Chris. As for Bob Kane, I think the guy is getting the lumps he deserved now. But I think we do have to remember that Kane wanted to be like the great comic strip artist he admired. So his position on Ghosts is like that of his idols. It doesn't excuse his behavior, especially him lying for the better part of 20 years when the truth began to come out in the 60s. But it does make it at least understandable, as Dan pointed out. Also, Kane did draw the strip at this point. His work is crude compared to Robinson and Sprang's later solo efforts, but it did have that Mysterioso quality that helped make the strip. It's just that without Finger, the strip wouldn't have been anything we know and love today. Dr. Ange from Comic Box Commentary wrote in to say, great episode, great issue. As you guys say, so much of the Englehart Rogers stuff was a love letter to these issues. The opening chapter of the Joker Fish pulls lines and panels directly from here. I loved their looks backwards at a time when I was interested in learning about comic history in any way. Things like these Treasuries, Digests, and the 30s to the 70s hardcovers were so helpful in the pre-internet days. And finally, David Ace Gutierrez, the executive producer of Pod Dylan, says, let's dig up Kane's body so we can punch him in the face. I don't know, maybe to some that seems extreme, but I would say if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So thanks everybody for writing in. I really appreciate it. I do want to mention we don't have any new iTunes reviews. We haven't had any in a while. So if you haven't left one, please do. It helps get the show mentioned. I haven't been bugging everybody about iTunes reviews, but I'm going to start doing it again. Please leave us, go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review about Treasury Cast if you enjoy it. And then finally, I need to thank the people on Twitter who gave us retweets, which is Rufus Hewitt 99, Adam of Gotham, DocRx 845. Inquiry 2, Trekker Talk, Rad Adventure, Supermates Pod, Jeff Hahn, 349-11855, Professor Frenzy, World Spine, Dan G. Comics, 13th Dimension, Classic JLA, Griffith Charles, Comics in the Golden Age, Ted Covington, Justice Trek, NF Strangers, BTB, Blog, Legion Blog, The Mind of Scott X, Warlord Worlds, It's Plastic Man, Maxo Romero, Firestorm Fan, and Iowa's Joe. So again, thanks everybody for the retweets. Helps the show get noticed. So thanks so much to Andy Leyland for coming by and talking Conan with me. This was a long in the production episode, and I'm glad we finally got a chance to do it. So I hope everybody enjoyed the show. Thanks everybody for listening. And until the next episode, go big or go home.
Conan, what is best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of their women. That is good.